I call the Agriculture, Finance, and Policy Committee meeting to order on April 2nd, 2024. I believe there is a quorum present. So with that, Vice Chair Prichelle, may I have a motion?
Madam Chair, I move to approve the minutes for March 21st, 2024.
March 21st. So Representative Prichelle moves approval of the minutes for March 21st, 2024. Any discussion? Hearing none, all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed say no. The motion prevails and the minutes for March 21st, 2024 are approved. So members, today we have an informational hearing. We're going to hear an update from the Minnesota Board of Animal Health to give us an update on the highly pathogenic avian influenza. If you can make your way before the committee, identify yourself for the record and proceed. Thank you for being here today.
My name is Dr. Brian Hayes. I am the Minnesota State Veterinarian and Executive Director for the Minnesota Board of Animal Health. Chair Vang and committee members, thank you for having me here today for this briefing. I did not intend when I visited a couple of months ago, a few weeks ago, when I talked about our high path updates, that I would be talking about high path avian influenza in species other than poultry. So to start off, just to give you an update on where high path avian influenza is in poultry since the first of the year. We have had three positive backyard flocks since January 1st of this year, one in Sherburne County, one in Stevens County, one in Clay County. No detections in Minnesota commercial operations. All of the 2023, so our fall cases, all of those have had their quarantines lifted and are underway for restocking those farms. Nationwide, there have only been 21 commercial detections since the beginning of the year. So this is on track with what we saw last spring with our high path outbreak, which amounted to just a handful of backyard flocks. And not to make light of that, but it's certainly a lot lighter load than what we had in the spring of 22, where we had kind of our explosion of high path avian influenza in poultry. With one of those backyard flocks, the Stevens County flock, we had an interesting turn of events. We actually ended up with a detection of the virus in goat kids that had been born around the same time as the flock that had been depopulated for detecting positive later in late February. The goat kids were towards the beginning of March. It's kind of an interesting interesting storm, I guess, is how I've described it. We're dealing with individuals, so these goat kids were neonates. They were less than a week of age. We know their immune systems are fragile at that point, not mature, so they are going to be more susceptible to viruses, bacteria that mature animals would not be. That combined with a high viral load of the birds that had been depopulated and released those viruses into the environment. And then these birds were sharing the environment with the goat. So it was kind of a free-ranging situation. The goats and the ducks and chickens on the farm all shared the same feed sources and water sources. So we had 10 goat kids that died during this time. Five of those tested positive to highly pathogenic avian influenza. The farmer was able to clean and disinfect the facilities, the watering system, and they have had no further mortalities in their goat kids, and their kidding season continued beyond. So we felt pretty confident. The message at that point was, this is an unusual case. This isn't something that we expect to pass additionally. I did several interviews at that point, and that was a question I was asked. How important is this for other livestock species? And all of the guidance I was given was, this is a dead end host. We won't likely see this in any other livestock. And then Texas proved me wrong. So that moves us into the dairy cattle situation that we're seeing in several states. So the beginning of this, we were talking about a mysterious syndrome in Texas dairy cattle. The syndrome seemed to be focused in the Texas panhandle. and kind of indistinct signs. We were hearing about dairy cattle that were going off feed, decreased gut motility, rumen motility, kind of dark, tacky manure. Some had indications of upper respiratory diseases. Some had some signs of mastitis. Honestly, it was a lot of kind of generic signs in cattle, kind of just your general sick cow signs. So nothing to be pointed at. Our counterparts in those states were doing a lot of research trying to determine what was causing this. At some point, someone decided to test for highly pathogenic avian influenza in these cattle and were able to detect the virus in milk. On March 25th, the USDA released confirmation that highly pathogenic avian influenza had been detected in cow milk from two Texas dairies and two Kansas dairies. One thing I need to point out here, and I will probably point this out repeatedly during this briefing, is the correlation between the sick cow syndrome and this virus has not been made. So it's a little bit confusing because we found this virus at the same time we are trying to deal with an unknown disease in those cattle. And I think by default it's kind of been lumped together as the cause. It may be and it may not be. As of last Friday, we had additional detections in Kansas and Michigan, as well as some pending test results in Idaho and New Mexico. Another theme of this briefing is going to be the information changes overnight. So I can tell you now that Idaho and New Mexico have been confirmed with positive high path avian influenza in milk from their dairy cattle as well. The USDA's preliminary investigation has indicated that this is a wild bird introduction. So the virus DNA sequencing that was done on the Texas dairy cattle was very consistent with the circulating highly pathogenic avian influenza in migratory birds in Texas. It's basically the same virus that's been circulating since 2022, with some variations as viruses do mutate over time. The transmission between cattle has not been ruled out. So this is kind of an interesting area of discussion amongst state veterinarians and USDA officials, trying to determine how this virus is getting into these dairies and subsequent dairies. So I'll point out the Michigan dairy, for example. There was a trace back. Some of the cattle from the Texas dairy ended up in Michigan, were imported, and Michigan cattle ended up positive for this virus. So cattle that originally were in Michigan and exposed to Texas cattle. The question is, did the cattle spread the disease, the virus, or was it introduced by birds? There's one camp that suggests that this is indicating a lateral spread between cattle, and there's another camp that is suggesting we don't have enough information to confirm that. Affected dairy cattle, as we know, are so sick cows in general. We isolate. We don't generally mix them with the rest of the cattle herd. In this situation, that's what's being done on these dairies. They're entering the sick pens. The cattle recover with little, no mortalities have been reported in cattle up to this point. So recoveries are occurring within about a 2-week time span. Most of those cattle are returning to the dairy herd. Some are culled for low production. There have been no official movement restrictions issued from Minnesota. One state did issue a stop movement of cattle from Texas, and that was Idaho. And 2 weeks later, Idaho had their first case in one of their dairy cattle. So the movement restriction didn't seem to have an effect on preventing the virus being detected in Idaho. Recently, I think it was yesterday, the state vet from Nebraska also issued it was termed a restriction. It really isn't a restriction. His requirement is that all breeding age dairy animals have to have a permit prior to being imported into the state. The idea behind that is to receive real-time information when these cattle move in. So they're not restricting cattle from moving to Nebraska. They just want to know when they're moving. So traditionally, paper Paper certificates of veterinary inspection can take a week to two to arrive at a state animal health official's office. By having a permit, we have the information instantly. They've contacted us to let us know that those cattle are moving. I say we because Minnesota already has a system like this in place before we even had this concern about high path avian influenza. We require cattle moving into the state, contact us directly for a permit so we know that they're moving and when they're moving. Dairy producers are being encouraged to minimize movement. I've been in contact with large dairies in Minnesota to determine what their production system looks like, how much risk there is of movement of cattle from these affected area. It's minimal at this point. They've self-restricted. So Minnesota has been very progressive on approaching this. The farmers understand the risk to their herds and they're not allowing movement from those heifer rearing facilities in the south at this time. Last statement there, no known risk to consumers in pasteurized dairy. We know pasteurization is effective at killing the virus and any bacteria. So drinking pasteurized milk has no health risk to people. That was my updates as of yesterday. And I have, as I said, this changes overnight, so I have additional updates. Yesterday we were informed that one of the workers at the Texas, one of the Texas farms did test positive for high path avian influenza. So he had developed a case of conjunctivitis. This virus for some reason likes to infect the eyes. So we do know that there is risk of exposure for workers. We are issuing guidance on that. PPE, obviously, we have some background in that with our poultry industry and how we guide our producers to avoid contracting the virus or overexposure to the virus. And they're the same guidances that we're giving to our dairy farm workers.
All right, questions from the committee. Representative Hansen.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, Director. Does the virus survive the cow's digestive tract?
Dr. Bryant.
Chair Vang, Representative Hansen, that's a good question. I've asked that question of the USDA. Can we verify this virus is not existing in manure? And those findings are yet to be determined. The feedback that I'm getting is it's unlikely, but I have not been convinced of it. I don't have proof of that.
Representative Hansen.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And how about movement in water?
Dr. Bryan.
Chair Vang, Representative Hansen. I think, I guess a clarification, are you talking about free water? Are you talking about potable water? I'll say the detection in the goats we are attributing to a contaminated water source on the farm. So if that's what you're referring to, yes, it can survive in the water.
Representative Hansen.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Yes, so if you have a water source and you have a contaminated livestock that drinks from that source and then other livestock drink from that source, can the transmission go, because it's alive in the water, the virus is still there?
Dr. Bryan.
Chair Vang and Representative Hansen, yes, that's how we feel the goats were infected from contaminated water.
Representative Hansen.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And to your knowledge, is there any, so is USDA doing any work on chasing the virus through these two methods that I just discussed? Is there, what research work is being done right now on this?
Dr. Bryan.
Chair Vang and Representative Hansen. Yes, the USDA is trying to research exactly how this virus is getting in. There's been research on virus sequencing. So up to this point, they have said it's the similar virus to what we see circulating. Again, late breaking news yesterday, they're telling me they're getting out farther in the sequencing and suggesting this could be a multiple introduction event, not just one type of virus. It might be several different bird incursions. So there's research going into how is this getting into the environment? How do we contain it? How do we disinfect it once it's in the environment?
Representative Hansen.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Any efforts being done on vaccine development, either for livestock or for people?
Dr. Bryan.
Chair Vang, Representative Hansen, the vaccination comment came up early. The problem with this virus is it's part of the influenza A family. And as we know, the influenza A virus that we vaccinate against in people is highly variable as far as determining which strain we're vaccinating against. So there's discussion about it. There's likely some research I don't know about that is underway. The rest of the equation is this affects international trade. So when we start talking about vaccinations, our trading partners get concerned about why we're vaccinating and the safety of the product that comes from those vaccinated animals. So it's above my pay grade. That's a federal level discussion and decision, but the discussion is being pushed from the state level. Multiple states have asked the same question. What are we doing as far as establishing vaccine protocols that might be helpful in the future?
Representative Hansen.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Well, I guess if it's a question between human health and trade, I'll go with human health. But do we know incubation period, transmission time, length of infection, any of those things? Is the CDC working on trying to determine those items?
Dr. Bryant.
Chair Vang and Representative Hansen, yes. Incubation periods seem to be about an average of 10 days. We see these, so 10 days before we would see signs, and then about a two-week period where those signs subside and the cattle return to normal.
Representative Hansen.
I think, Madam Chair, so then this could be farther out now than we know. We could be at a just becoming aware if it takes 10 days to express itself. Is that correct?
Dr. Bryan?
Chair Vang, Representative Hansen, yes. I think there's a lot of unknowns. I think the statement can even be made, has this always been there? That's kind of the burning question in a lot of our minds. Are we just finding it because we're just looking for it? This mystery disease in cattle was frustrating. Similarly, the goat kids that were dying, that was a frustrating situation trying to determine cause of death. So at that point, our investigators, researchers start looking for the stranger things that wouldn't seem as likely. So that was my comment earlier about we don't know if this virus is causing that disease, but now we found the virus and now we're looking for it. So I think that's an excellent point, excellent question. Where is it? How long has it been here? And is this just the tip of the iceberg? I think that's all yet to be determined.
Representative Hansen.
And then finally, so just your response of deploying Board of Animal Health staff or veterinarians and the private sector, what guidance are you providing in terms of their health and safety as we try to discover at these initial stages?
Dr. Bryant.
Chair Vang, Representative Hansen, we've been working very closely with Minnesota Milk and the University Extension, Dairy Extension, to kind of come up with guidance documents, guidance information. So specifically biosecurity, it's very similar to some of the talking points that we discussed with poultry. Maintaining biosecurity on your farms, not having a lot of visitors on your farm. PPE, we know that that's going to be crucial in preventing exposure if we're talking about the case in Texas where we had conjunctivitis. Certainly eye protection seems a logical part of the PPE toolkit. So in addition, we're telling producers make sure to use hygiene when you're dealing with raw milk. So I grew up on a dairy farm. We dipped a pitcher in the milk for breakfast every morning. Not a good idea in light of this information. So that's the other thing. Don't handle raw milk without PPE and consume pasteurized milk and you will avoid the virus.
Representative Anderson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Doctor, thank you. This is something new and different, and a couple of questions too. You know, we've had, as far as I can recall, the bird flu back in 2017 and then a couple of years ago and then last year as well. And this is the first instance, at least that we're aware of the spread to other species. And you kind of talked about that, that it may have been around here before and we didn't really look for it. You know, and the thought comes, is this virus mutating? Is it changing at all? Or what can you tell about that type of thing?
Dr. Bryan.
Chair Vang, Representative Anderson. Great question. The CDC is telling us this virus has not mutated to be more infectious to mammals or humans. So they're telling us it's normal mutation for a virus of this group, but it doesn't reflect mutations that cause more infectious events in mammals. So why we're finding it is a question I can't answer, other than we're looking for it.
Okay. Representative Anderson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Can you give us some idea of the percentage in a herd, at least in Texas or wherever, Kansas? Is it one cow? Is it 10 cows? Like 1%, 5%? How many of the animals in these locations have been diagnosed with the virus?
Dr. Bryan.
Chair Vang, Representative Anderson. It's been a little bit variable. I think on average the affected sites are reporting about a 10% morbidity rate, so 10% infected or cattle showing signs of this mystery disease. Again, I can't say that's what the virus is doing to them. Those are the cattle that are being tested because they're sick already. So they're trying to determine what's causing the illness, but that's the report. This mystery dairy syndrome has been affecting about 10% of dairy cattle in some herds.
Representative Anderson.
Thanks again, Madam Chair. And as far as the cows themselves that are affected, again, generalizing, can you say they're heifers, first calf heifers, older cows, stage of lactation? What about that?
Dr. Bryan.
Chair Vang, Representative Anderson. That's another great question. Up to this point, I would have said it's all mid to late term mature cows, mid to late lactation mature cows. There have been some reports of younger cattle testing positive as well. So first lactation heifers have tested positive. Overwhelming majority are those mature cows, mid to late lactation, however.
Representative Jacob.
Thank you, Chair Vang. So if we know that pasteurization kills the virus, is there a certain temperature range, either freezing or heating, that we know is effective on it?
Dr. Bryan.
Chair Vang, Representative Jacobs. The heating is what will kill the virus. Refrigeration or freezing would actually allow the virus to survive.
Okay. Thank
Representative
you.
Jacobs.
Thank you.
Representative Burkle.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and I trust that knowing my personal experience with the Board of Animal Health and they're dealing with ThyPath, that this will be handled properly and very well. I just want to bring to light, and I know, Chair Vang, we talked about this last week, but there is a bill floating around that I've authored to fund a grant mitigation program. I'm hoping we could maybe hear that yet at some point, but you know, laser light systems, you're probably aware of what we're talking about. That maybe needs to include dairy as well, but I'm just curious what you think the effectiveness of that would be going forward and if those kinds of deterrents would have some kind of effect on farms.
Dr. Bryan.
Chair Vang, Representative Burkle. I think the research has shown that it is effective at deterring birds from entering those areas. That's the first step in preventing the virus from coming into the environment, obviously.
Representative Burkle.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Knowing that there are effective methods to somehow mitigate this and knowing that wild birds are really the vector, I think it's really imperative that we have that discussion at some point. And I would hope that maybe before we get the supplemental budget done, we could maybe hear that bill. That's all I'd ask, Chair Vang. Thank you.
That is duly noted, Representative Burkle. Further questions, Representative Nelson?
Thank you, Chair Vang. And Dr. Yuda had a Chair Hansen had a question on, you know, water being able to, you know, hold the virus. Is there does it have to be in a host or can it be in water and stay a viable virus, or what's the, you know, thinking of decontamination and things like that, if, you know, what, how long of a period can it stay alive?
Dr. Bryan.
Chair Vang, Representative, I don't know the exact duration that it can survive in the environment. Typically, we consider it not being able to survive long in the environment. That's usually because of drying out. So obviously, in a water source, it's going to have a longer lifespan, so to speak. I don't have the exact time frame. We've been giving guidance to clean and disinfect your waters at least once a week, and that seems to be effective in at least our goat farm situation. That seemed to help prevent further incursions.
Representative Nelson.
Thank you, and you know, follow up with that. You know, is there guidance as far as, you know, what type of disinfectant should be used and things like that? You know, if people want to go and you know, take proactive steps on their own, on, you know, just making sure their water fountains and things like that are clean for their animals. You know, what types of disinfectant should be used?
Dr. Bryan.
Chair Fang, Representative, there's the virus is actually not very stable in the face of a disinfectant, so most disinfectants are very, very useful in the situation. So anything from bleach to some of the other disinfectants we use routinely in dairy operations would be effective at destroying the virus.
Representative Nelson.
Thank you.
Representative Anderson.
Thank you again for indulging me, Madam Chair. Representative Burkle raised a good point in terms of things we could do to get ahead of this possibly. And the folks from the Department of Ag are here. We have an emergency fund for situations that may arise out of things like this. Could anybody from the department comment on what they're doing, what they're thinking of doing in terms of, again, being proactive on this and what they would need or what they have available in their emergency fund right now?
Welcome, Commissioner. If you can identify yourself before the record and proceed.
Madam Chair and members, to Representative Anderson's question, a couple of things on that. We do have our emergency management account, and we are pretty well funded in that right now. But we also, you know, as we look at, you know, we have somewhere north of $2 million of the, I think we had $4 million at one time, and then, you know, we had the outbreak last fall. We're also waiting. A lot of times we front money, so we might buy foam or things like that, and then we get reimbursed. So we're also waiting for that. We have a cooperative agreement with the USDA, and that is kind of nice to have that fund because when things come up, we can spend. Right now, at this moment, we don't have any specific asks. We also, you know, as we look for those on responses, you know, because 2 years ago we had 100 cases in the springtime. So if we got into a situation like that, which, you know, knock on wood, we only had 2 cases last spring. And so as we look at how we prepare and spend those dollars, we try to keep that reserve, you know, for response, but we can work on some of the proactive measures. What we did, kind of to represent Burkle's point, one thing that we did is we took some of the flexibility in Agri, and that's what's nice, and we issued what's called a Protect Grant this last spring, or this spring, and it just closed first part of March, and we did made that eligible for farmers, but we put a real big emphasis on a chronic wasting disease and deer fencing because those farmers need to comply by September 1st, so really to help move that, and then also for turkey farms, so we had, or poultry farms, so we did put in $500,000 just to kind of see how that would work, and we did have quite a few turkey farms apply for lasers, netting, fencing, all kinds of things to help keep that out. So that's, we worked with an Agri on that rather than the emergency account, but it's something that we'll continue to consider. You know, we're always, you know, just leery as we look at, you know, what are the uses. We work very closely with Dr. Hayes and his team on, you know, what are the kind of things that we might, you know, need as we look out into this. So far, we don't have any, you know, things that we're doing right now, but, you know, always, you know, willing to look, and we communicate, you know, quite regularly, but leave it at that.
Okay. Further questions? Representative Hanson.
Thank you, Madam Chair and Commissioner. You know, sometimes diseases take a long time to express themselves or they have chronic impairment to the animals. So what happens if this gets into a dairy with over 10,000 cows, or we have some of these very large entities where it could race through? I mean, it's one thing to euthanize chickens and turkeys.
Commissioner Peterson.
Madam Chair and Representative Hansen, you know, the good thing, and Dr. Hayes is the doctor here, but, you know, we're seeing those cows recover, you know, at this point, that it's not a, we're not losing animals, so they're going into the hospital pen, and that, you know, you can have some other things that go through the herd, and that can be normal. So right now, it's hasn't been a, you know, a bad piece, and we hope that it doesn't get worse, but I think that's what, you know, also, you know, encouraging farms to prepare for that, you know, and have room and have a setup. Most farms, especially larger farms, have a, you know, a hospital unit and set up that they're ready to move those cows in and get them back working. But, you know, all the farms that I've seen so far, they've been able to, you know, the cows have been able to recover, including on the, and those are larger scale dairies too, is my understanding.
Representative Hansen.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And perhaps we need to look at the manure management and water, if those are reservoirs for cross-contamination, particularly if we have a wild environment, wild game that can come in contact and just move. The vectors can move pretty fast.
Commissioner Peterson.
Madam Chair and Representative Hansen, and, you know, I just say, too, this is a team effort, you know. We work very closely also with the Department of Health, but also U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service and the DNR. You know, we work very closely on watching the bird cast and the migration patterns. And so, and the USDA APHIS also on, they're actually doing a study right now, includes Minnesota, and looking at the bird population near some of the farms and everything. And we'll have some of those reports hopefully sometime this year. And so there are a lot of those different efforts going on.
Further questions from the committee? All right. Any closing remarks, Commissioner or Dr. Bryan?
I'm just going to reiterate, the virus is there. We don't know exactly what it's doing. The news changes daily, so there will be more updates. We'd encourage you to look at our website. Our communications director does a great job of keeping those talking points current. So as we learn more, we will be sharing more.
Thank you, Dr. Bryan. Commissioner?
And Madam Chair, and thank you. And same, what we tried to do as the department, as the board's the lead on it, that we try to amplify their message. We also led the stakeholder call this week, and we'll continue to look at if we're, you know, going to continue to do something that within Minnesota. You know, and then just also remind the public too that, you know, as pasteurized milk is safe, and there's not a huge human health risk here, and cook your meat, it's you know, all very safe to do, and we'll continue to amplify that message too as well.
All right. Thank you, Commissioner. Thank you, Dr. Bryan, for coming before the committee on this important update. And with that, members, that is all that we have for today. Our next meeting is Thursday, April 4th, 2024. This meeting is adjourned.